read to him the 29th scroll. 6th verse.
Beware the beast man, for he is the devil's pawn. Alone among God's primates, he kills for sport or lust or greed. Yea, he will murder his brother to possess his brother's land. Let him not breed in great numbers, for he will make a desert of his home and yours. Shun him, drive him back into his jungle lair, for he is the harbinger of death.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast, Planet of the Apes Retrospective Series.
My friends, I have convened this extraordinary meeting of the Council in order that I may report upon an action which I deemed necessary.
Join Matt.
You are a good and wise ape.
Garrett.
The human way is violence and death.
And Adam.
The only thing they fear more than me is you apes.
As they travel through the spectrum of Earth and into the Forbidden Zone, and consequently dissect the most primitive of all film franchises.
My God, did we finally do it?
From the Charlton Heston starring 1968 original,
take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
To director Tim Burton's 2001 remake,
we've been searching for you for so long.
All the way through the latest entry, 2024's Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
I don't believe it!
The man will see, the man will do, their opinions of how good or inferior each movie in the series truly is.
He has a definite gift for mimicry.
All coming up, courtesy of Percolated Media.
All of human history has led to this moment.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Released May 10th, 2024. Budget on this was $160 million. Currently, box office gross of $237 million. And this was directed by Wes Ball. What a wonderful day, boys. We have arrived at the final, for now at least, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes movie. Number 10 in this series, which is kind of crazy to think about. We got 45 years and 10 movies.
Crazy to think about, and also, just to kind of peek behind the curtain a bit. Those shows are running now as we record this, but we actually recorded them, what, like 3 months ago? So this was what we were building up to, and it was a long time coming. We started at the beginning of the year, and we're ending it halfway into the year.
Well, trust me, if we could have recorded that movie, this one, sooner, I certainly would have. But at the same time, let's get into this movie now, because at least I previewed as we were building up to this one, I was not overly excited that this was coming out, even from when it was announced. Because let's remember, War for the Planet of the Apes really tied everything up. The story was over, for all intents and purposes, and I felt more than satisfied leaving Planet of the Apes behind. But, lo and behold, as War for the Planet of the Apes had come out, there were talks of maybe doing a fourth one, especially from Matt Reeves. He teased that he had some ideas, but when Gotham City raised the bat signal, he sort of ran to do that. And I don't blame him. He had done two movies in this franchise, and getting a Batman gig is a huge opportunity.
It's kind of like how Bryan Singer left the X-Men series to do Superman. It's just like, well, if you want to do a hero, then that's the hero you do, you know, if you're a big fan of it. So apparently he was a huge fan of Batman and took off for it, which, you know, I don't blame him either, because these movies, they are so intricate, and the effects and everything else that goes into it, it's got to be tough. Not that Batman's any easier, but I'm just saying, just from an effect standpoint, it must have been more fun to work on a practical level as opposed to all the goddamn visual effects you have to work with this one.
Well, unlike Bryan Singer, Matt Reeves can at least say he finished his Apes trilogy before he left.
That's true.
And it was kind of in lull for about a year and a half until the big news, 20th Century Fox was acquired by Disney, and almost immediately they announced, oh yeah, we're doing more Planet of the Apes movies. When I heard that, I thought, okay, does that mean they're going to reboot? Does that mean they're going to continue? Does that mean they're going to do another remake? Which honestly would not have surprised me, because I could picture Disney wanting to put their own stamp on it. But around a couple months after that, they announced that, yeah, we are going to be continuing the series, albeit with a time jump. So it's the same universe that Rise started, but we're going to be picking up a considerable amount of time later. So, Adam, when you heard that, what was your input?
I was a little worried about Disney when they decided, ooh, you know what, it's our turn, we're going to do it. Because Disney deciding that they're going to take over some of the properties that existed at Fox, I don't think they've all done very well. I think mixed results would be generous. The time jump, it's an easy way to say we're going to reboot it without rebooting. Because you're able to carve out a time frame, you're able to put it there, and you can decide what or what not you're going to include. But then the downside of that is it's prequelitis type stuff. Because, yeah, it's a sequel, but it's also a prequel. And as we've discussed in a lot of franchises the three of us have discussed, that's an extremely mixed bag. It's iffy, and then more and more into production. You know, when it was like, oh, Caesar's dead, so it's carrying on. I'm like, well, you got rid of the actor and kind of the face of that original franchise that we cared about. And then when you decide that, who are you going to get? Ooh, the guy who's known for such action blockbusters as the Maze Runner franchise and all the special features on DVDs from the early 90s or early aughts. There was nothing ahead of time that made me go, man, I can't wait.
Yeah, and I text you guys when they were amping up the marketing for this. Who was front and center in all of that marketing material? Andy Serkis himself, even though he's not even in the goddamn movie. So yeah, that gave me a little cause for concern. But I will tell you guys, I did watch the Maze Runner movies to prepare myself for this. And you know what? They're not bad. Honestly, the first one's better than the second. I'm kind of a sucker for... as people know, kind of the teen drama associated with stuff like that. But you know what? They weren't that bad. And it did prove to me that he could handle something, this rest ball that we're talking about. He could handle these types of action scenes and these types of effects that, you know what? It gave me a better outlook of this movie because I'm just like Matt. I was like, you know, as big of a fan as Matt is, I kind of grew to be a bit of a fan, although War didn't, I wasn't as big of a fan of that as you guys were. But I came out of watching War, I was like, I'm done. I don't need anything else. And then I hear, you know, they're not even bringing Caesar back. Of course, he's dead. But we're gonna have to, like, after three movies and, what was it, 3 movies and 6 years, now we're gonna have to get used to a whole new set of characters, a whole new set of apes. And I didn't even know until I walked in that theater, because I didn't look at the poster, that we weren't gonna have fucking humans in this either. So I also was not looking forward to this at all.
I would equate this, and it's easy to do this because the circumstances are kind of similar but also different. This reminds me of when they announced Toy Story 4, where even though I was not as hot, I sort of felt about Toy Story 3, Garrett, the way you felt about War for the Planet of the Apes, if you recall. In fact, mm-hmm. My thoughts on Toy Story really echo your thoughts on this Apes trilogy, where I liked the first one, loved the second one, thought the third one was good, but kind of my least favorite. And then they said, oh yeah, we're doing a fourth one. And I was like, why? This story is over. What else can you do? And I liked Toy Story 4, but I will tell you it's far and away the weakest of the four. So that was kind of the equivalent franchise I had in my head from the moment this was announced.
And I'll tell you one other thing, and it's something that Adam mentioned that scares me to fucking death when we get to another franchise later on this summer, is Disney acquired 20th Century Fox, meaning they got the rights to this. They have the rights to another series we're going to be doing. It scares me too, because we're going to be talking Star Wars sequels pretty soon, and... as people know, I in my first viewings of those, I wasn't a big fan of those either. So Disney has really dropped the ball when it comes to... And Indiana Jones last year, for Christ's sake. They broke my fucking heart with that series.
Realize they have an Alien movie coming out this year.
Well, that's what I said. This franchise that we're going to talk about later on this year. Yeah, they also scare me with that. Another franchise near and dear to my fucking heart. So while Apes was never near and dear to me, I hadn't seen the majority of these films. I also walked in, you know what? I don't have any faith that they can do this any justice, even as somebody who was not a fan of it. So as somebody who's a huge fan of these franchises coming up, it scared me. I gotta say, it's really, really scaring me.
Now, the one thing that gave me some hope is when Prey came out, either last year or the year before, where that was a Fox property that had kind of gone downhill, because look, there's one good Predator movie and that's it, in my opinion, until Prey came out. So I thought, okay, that's kind of a comparable franchise to compare this new Apes movie to. But as far as West Ball goes, I've only seen the first Maze Runner, and outside of Harry Potter and half the Hunger Games movies, I really don't care for that subgenre. So I can't tell you that I was dying to see another Maze Runner movie after walking out of the first one. So the fact that he was coming in to direct these, not going to say I hated the decision, but it just seemed to me like, who's available? Who's done something about similar scale? And who can we get on the cheap to helm this?
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Matt, but that's the thing. You know, we've discussed it a million times. Who do they go for? Well, they're not going for somebody who's necessarily qualified and has done films similar to this. They're going for somebody on the cheap. And I guarantee this guy was very cheap to get.
Well, this is kind of the... It seems like they went to a director from the MCU school of get somebody on. Somebody who shows he's competent in, you know, that type of effects work. I mean, Maze Runner, the first one's... okay at best. I mean, it's whatever, it's Twilight. The second one did worse so much that the third one they just threw onto TV after they got done doing it. But he can film effects and a lot of that type of post-filming work he can get done. But I think maybe the big thing was is he's helmed to do a pretty big movie after this. I think that hiring got him this job. Just because of how schedules and stuff work. And look at the people that Marvel brought on. You know, it was like, hey, this is what we're making. Can you do it on our budget and our time frame? And I think that's who they got. I don't think a lot of people knew Westfall beforehand. I sure as heck didn't by name, but I think this is going to start him at least around for a while. But nobody knew who the Russo brothers were.
No, and Marvel sort of went through a shift where they started out getting more people with distinctive voices. Like, you get Kenneth Branagh to direct Thor. I thought that was a pretty big get.
Yeah, back when it was Paramount and Universal.
That yeah, because I think the last one was when they got Shane Black for Iron Man 3, where it's like, he's got a very distinctive voice. Whether you love that movie or hate it, it feels like him. And I was like, okay, can you do that for Planet of the Apes when there's such a... There's an expectation of what to get with these movies. And I also feel bad because that last trilogy set the bar pretty damn high. So I don't envy whoever was tasked with putting this movie together. And speaking of the cheap, no one in this cast is a big name. There is no Andy Serkis to draw people. And to a lesser extent, there's no James Franco, who was pretty popular because of the Spider-Man movies. Can't find a comparable one in this cast.
No, I mean, the biggest star of this film is Weta. If you're going to make someone top bill, it might as well be Weta.
Well, the girl in this, I had seen in Baghead earlier this year, and she was also a big part of The Witcher, which was on Netflix as well. So she's kind of a name, but you're right. There's nobody who jumps off the poster and makes you say, oh, I got to see it for so-and-so. Even the apes, you know. I mean, Kevin Durant I've seen around. You know, he's played big, bad guys. William H. Macy is in here, as small of a part as he has. So there are names here, but there's nobody who jumps off and makes you want to come see it. You know, there's not a Mark Wahlberg, if we can go back to the 2001 remake. Say what you will about him. Back then, he was a decent enough star where he could draw people in. There's nobody like that here.
Your point of Freya Allen being in this, the female character, not to spoil anything, but after 2.5 hours, me going, man, she looks familiar, man, she looks familiar, and me going to IMDb, that's what it took for me to realize that she's somebody that I watched for three seasons in The Witcher. So even though I have devoured those, I still didn't recognize who she was. But she didn't have the Siri look.
And my lack of anticipation was further heightened by when we started seeing the trailers. I told myself, the effects have gotten better, which is impressive considering how great they are in the previous films, but they just keep perfecting it. But outside of that, nothing in these trailers was hooking me. A lot of it was stuff I felt like I had seen before, not just from Apes, but other science fiction properties. And I was not particularly impressed with what they were setting up with, like, okay, we have another character named Nova that's a woman. We have another... Sort of like this reminds me of The Walking Dead, where I'm like, okay, they keep doing the same story framework, where it's they go to a new place that's run by some kind of tyrant, and they have to break out or rebel. That's kind of what I was seeing here, and not that I was dreading going to see this, but I was not excited walking into that theater. What about you boys?
I mean, when this was announced, I don't know if we were actively discussing that we were going to be going through this, and I saw the first teaser, which was just the, you know, that shot of the apes and then the hawk landing on his arm, and that was it. Did nothing for me. I was like, okay, it's another one that looks like what we've gotten before. And at that point, I hadn't even seen I hadn't seen Dawn of War at that point. And the only other thing I had watched, and I think I saw it in a theater, was I saw the first trailer, the one where the first time that we see Proxima, third time we're discussing a name that sounds like this recently, that first trailer where he's like, it's a wonderful day. I'd seen that trailer once. And after that, I stayed away from everything because by that time I knew we were going to see it. So I was kind of like, you know what? I'm going to completely back off. I'm going to do, and I usually don't do this. I did no looking up. I did no additional trailers. I didn't, if it was coming on TV, I'd change the channel. I wanted this to be the first one I went in as virgin as possible, not knowing anything. Because whether I was happy or not, I was going to see it. So I kind of wanted to be a blank slate, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, I also stayed away from the majority of the trailers. The only one I saw was me and Jen saw the teaser when we went to see Something last year. That was it. I did not see the other trailers, but like I mentioned, I mean, if I went on Facebook every single day, there was an ad for this staring me in the face, being hyped up by Andy Serkis. So I also stayed away from the marketing, but I'll tell you one thing that scared me, boys. One thing that really scared me about this movie was when I saw the fucking runtime. There is not one of these goddamn franchise movies that can go in under 2.5 fucking hours. That just blew me away. It has worked out in the past. You know, we're going to get to a franchise probably next year where they had a sequel that ended up going almost longer than that, actually, and ended up being very, very good and very, very good for that particular movie. It went by in a flash. But I got to tell you, I walked in that theater. I was like, whoa, I have over 2.5 hours with this. I sure as hell hope it's good.
You know, the one other thing they did, and I think it was very localized. I don't think they did this anywhere else, but I work in San Francisco here on the West Coast. They did in full physical outfits. They had apes riding horses around the waterfront of San Francisco by the Golden Gate Bridge, unannounced until the press showed up. And these people in outfits look just like they do in the film. So it was all over my feed, you know, one day since I operate trains in the area. But they had apes on horseback going through San Francisco. And the genius piece of not-so-guerrilla marketing.
Well, now I have to ask, because I used to live over there as well. Was this part of the marketing, or was this just people going out in costumes and roaming those streets? Because I know the people in San Francisco, they are known to do shit like that.
It's, you know what? It was at the Presidio, so unfortunately that area was cleaned up. So yeah.
This, okay. All right.
It's not the rest of the city.
Okay.
Well, you know, certain gay pride parades have gotten really ambitious lately.
That's when the bears come out.
Yeah. Yeah, if we ever do bears or otters. I don't know if Rise of the Kingdom of the Otters, that ever comes out. You're right, Garrett. I'm getting old because I realize that anytime I see a movie over 2 hours, I kind of have to mentally prepare myself. And I swear that's a Disney mandate, because Indiana Jones was 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Disney Star Wars, those are all over 2 hours. Eternals, I'm like, for the love of God, can we get a movie under 2 hours, please, that I can review on these airwaves to save me from these plot synopsis?
Exactly.
Those are the ones they dump on Hulu.
Yeah.
Like, when Prey was 1.5 hours, I was like, oh, thank God.
No shit. Now, how'd you guys see this? I believe I went opening weekend, and I went by myself because I was going to take my fiance, but we ended up doing something else that night. So I ended up going. It was an off day at work, and I went to an early showing of this. On his first Thursday out, I went to a, I think it was like a 2-3 o'clock showing of this. And you know what? For a 3 o'clock showing on a Thursday, it was pretty crowded. I had about half, a little more than half full. Again, by myself. I'm just kind of sitting in my corner seat with my notepad and my popcorn and my Slurpee, and I was sitting there and pretty decently filled.
I went Friday night because I had a plane to catch the next day, and I knew I wanted to get this viewing in before vacation. So I went, it was like 8 o'clock, 7:30, somewhere around that. Not packed, but good amount of people in that theater, which reflects the movie's doing well financially.
Yeah.
All things considered, you know, it's been out little over a week at this point, and it's made almost $250 million. So hopefully it keeps building momentum, because as this movie accentuates, and we'll talk about it, they're clearly setting up for more movies. This is not a standalone installment by any means.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I thought I was going to go see it myself. I was planning to see it opening weekend. Then I got a message from my dad that was just like, hey, there's a new Apes movie. Why don't we go see it together? And I haven't got a chance to go see a movie in a theater with my dad for quite a while, and I had to wait an extra week, and I'm glad I did, because, you know, I've mentioned on other podcasts, other discussions we've had, that we've seen a lot of movies together since I saw Return of the Jedi. He took me to 2010, for God's sake, so they haven't all been fingers.
Oh, God, we should buy him a gift for doing it.
Yeah.
And realized, like, the age that I was going to 2010. You know, but he took me to see Predator 2 on my 12th birthday. So, you know, he made it up. So it was kind of a really sweet thing. I just had to wait an extra week, drove out to see him. And we saw it in a nice you know, giant screen. It wasn't IMAX. It was faux IMAX, nice powered recliners. It was a really nice feeling to be able to take my dad into a sci-fi series that we had never actually watched together, but discussed it because he knew we were discussing it, the three of us. So we've talked about it a lot recently, and I was like, let's go see the new one. And I'm glad we did, because both of our wives went, yeah, you boys go do it. My wife and my new stepmother had no interest in seeing this whatsoever.
Yeah, I figured, because she's going to be going with me next week to a movie that me and Matt are going to be reviewing that we'll mention at the end of this podcast. So I just thought, you know what? I'm just going to not take her to both of these. I'll take her to one of them. But she's actually kind of anxious to see that one, believe it or not. So we'll reveal what that is at the end of this podcast.
That doesn't seem like her type of movie.
So yeah, exactly.
I'm kind of surprised, but we'll let that cat out of bag at the end of this show. But we got a movie to discuss. So
yep. Barrel of Monkeys.
As usual, for a new release, full spoilers ahead, so listen at your own discretion. 3, 2, 1. Give everyone some time to click off. All right. So, this movie opens with the epilogue of the previous trilogy. They don't start right away with Many Years Later, where we see Caesar being burned Darth Vader style.
Yeah.
I hope they didn't call Andy Serkis to film just this one scene of him just lying there.
Yeah, that was an interesting way to start this, because again, I knew going in, I didn't know how much in the future we're going to go. I knew we were going to go a little bit in the future, but to take it immediately to Caesar's, as you said, Jedi burial was an interesting way to go for a movie that's going to jump ahead a set of centuries.
I was surprised at first, and then I went, you know what? Kind of a good choice, because it ties it to that other one. It's a good choice if you think it should be tied to the other ones, I guess I should say. Because as much as it's a standalone, this says, hey, we're part of that. And respect the past because of how nice the tracks are that it laid down. But yeah, it kind of lets you know, yeah, sure hope you know what's going on. You don't have to, but it sure helps.
It helps because of what Caesar becomes throughout the course of this movie. So I do kind of like how it ties in that way.
Yeah, and I can't remember. This one also starts off with text, right?
Yes, it does. Just like the, and it does that same thing where kind of it has a wall of text, and then it leaves a word.
Yes.
That was the title of the previous one. So
yeah.
This doesn't feel like a new trilogy as much as it feels like the fourth part of a series.
Yeah, this feels more like a sequel than it does a soft reboot or anything.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. I was worried about how they were going to transition, because we knew this was a 300-year time jump. And seeing, you know, Maurice and Rocket, some of the mainstays from the previous film, you know, survive the end of war, so I thought we'd see what happened to them. But we don't. They jump 300 years later, and we're introduced to our main character of this movie, Noah. Nice reference, because this movie's got plenty of biblical components.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, and a lot of references to the very first one, too, which I kind of liked, and we'll get to those when we get to them.
But he's getting ready for his, sort of like what the apes do as their journey into adulthood, where they have to collect eagle eggs with his two friends, Ron and Hermione. I mean, Anaya and Suna. So, it's tough to jump from Caesar to a new character. That was always going to be, I think, the biggest challenge this series of new ones face, because not having Andy Serkis, that's a huge loss.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say he's on par, but I thought Noah was perfectly serviceable for the story they're telling.
Yeah, I will say, again, I was not looking forward to getting acquainted with new characters. So after this burning of Caesar, I'm thinking, okay, now I have to pay attention to who I have to pay attention to, because now I have to get acquainted with somebody else really quick here. Now, again, this is a 2.5-hour movie, so you know, I thought maybe they would take their time, but no. As soon as we see these three, I knew right away who to pay attention to, and I like the way this is done. You know, we're not seeing them be totally respected. These are, what, teenagers, right? They're supposed to be teenagers. So we're seeing a little bit of a growing phase here from this character that I immediately knew. We'll talk about the shenanigans they get into here in a bit, but I like the way they are introduced because it allowed me to say, okay, I need to pay attention to this particular character. I don't have Andy Serkis in my head. You know, I don't even know this actor who plays this character, but I know who to pay attention to now.
I agree. The way they focused on these three here starting off, I knew what the focus was going to be, and I thought it was a smart way they did so. Having an entire scene introducing us to our characters kind of let us know who to pay attention to. Smart.
So yeah. One thing I really have to compliment this movie for, right out of the gate, is they didn't feel the urgency to have the apes be like they are in the original series, where they're fully speaking English. Here they're still primarily communicating through sign language, and they speak here and there. But I like that it's not one of these things where, okay, because we're 300 years in the future, we have to get everything as advanced as possible. It's still, pardon the pun, parts of it are still pretty primitive.
To other studios, or same studio, who might be doing a film or a prequel or an interquel, hey, look, you can still have stepping stones and you don't have to shove everything into one frickin' movie.
Yeah.
I appreciated it.
More importantly, in a lot of franchises, like this movie in particular, is a lot about legacy and how legend can be twisted. I'm glad that these main characters, none of them are related to Caesar, which I thought for sure Noah was going to be like the great-great-great descendant of. I'm glad he's of his own tribe, and they didn't feel the need to tie this in through bloodlines like another franchise has done that we'll talk about soon.
Yeah, I knew you were going to pick up on that, Matt. I knew as soon as they did that, I'm like, okay, Matt's going to pick up on the fact that they did not quote-unquote shrink this universe. These are apes and monkeys that have lived on the legacy of Caesar, and I do like how his legacy and his presence is throughout this movie without actually being in this movie, and I didn't know how they would pull that off, but we'll see the way his legacy's been twisted. But at this point, we hear his name, they mention it, but it's like the way a lot of people in our world look at Jesus. It's kind of the same thing.
Oh, he is very much the Jesus Christ figure of apes, right down to their scripture, the way some people worship him with reverence versus the way people interpret what he believed to suit their own motives. There's definitely that aspect that is explored here. Because this movie is very, much like the previous films, they always have a message or they're about something. This one's really about religion and faith. That's like the real thematic thing throughout this. And I was surprised they went there because, you know, it's 2024 and we're as divided as ever still.
Yeah.
So to put that out there, I thought was pretty commendable. They're trying to collect these eggs out of the giant bird nest, and all I could think of was M. Night Shyamalan's After Earth.
Oh, Christ.
When I saw these giant, or that old that Bugs Bunny cartoon, yeah. I'm not one of us.
Yeah, they're getting into shenanigans. They are not well-behaved apes. You know, these are kids. These are teenagers. And I kind of like that. You know, we never really saw Caesar do stuff like this. We saw him grow up, but influenced by other things around him. These apes are doing their own thing, and I love that.
Yeah, Caesar's upbringing was through domestication, not through...
Exactly, yeah.
You know, wildlife, and we're seeing that they have to get these eggs and have to take care of them as they transition into adulthood. So they managed to grab a couple, get into some hijinks, and as they're walking back, they come across what they believe to be a human of some kind through the bridge. So they're kind of teasing that humans have not gone extinct, but they're sort of hearkening back to the 1968 movie where they're really primitive and animalistic. So I like that they're teasing that right at the forefront. In a lot of ways, this opening kind of mirrors the setup of the astronauts at the beginning of Planet of the Apes.
I thought of that too.
You know, and this movie has a lot of references without feeling too member berries-ish, which I appreciate. There's a couple that are pretty blatant that I did roll my eyes at, but they get back and we're seeing that this ape society is no longer, as you would expect, like a uniform society where it's just one clan. This is just one ape group out of basically the entirety of the planet at this point, where they're just keeping to themselves. It's like one of those old Native American villages where they have their own systems and they've built these tree houses. So I like the world that they're setting up here.
I like the look of this too. I am kind of enraptured right away. This looks real. And it's, of course it does, it's photorealistic, yada yada. But even the decisions they make, that they use electrical towers, that they build these tree houses out, there seems to be a thought process to the way these look and the quality that's put into them that just bring that heightened sense of reality, that it doesn't feel like it's a detached sci-fi. That this does feel like a future dystopian for the apes type of way, that I'm like, we're looking at apes, we haven't seen much else, but nothing in this feels animated. Even the mocap type animation. I'm really struck right away by just how gorgeous this looks.
Oh my God, let's get into that right now. The mocap in this, the special effects in this, fucking seamless. Even in that 2011 movie, which the three of us praised pretty well for its effects, they have leaped tall buildings with what they are able to do now. These apes look so real that I was questioning whether they had people in costumes or if they got actual apes in this movie. The way their faces move, the way their expressions are, and we're going to see a lot of water later that they get wet in, that they look fine in, which has always been a problem with animators, is water on fur. These apes are seamless, and the effects in this really, really work so well for me.
This franchise really is the most, maybe the textbook example of utilizing technology in filmmaking the way it's meant to be. It's an enhancement tool for storytelling. It's not the entire replacement. I think what they've done here, it improves every movie. I think this is as streamlined as it's ever going to get. Maybe it'll get better in the couple years between now and another movie if that comes out. But in an era where a lot of these big movies, we complain about the effects looking unfinished and a lack of polish, there was really a lot of care they put into this.
I think this could have been one of the reasons that Disney right away went into making this, is to have that relationship with Weta, to bring it into the Disney fold, because they've had issues. They've had issues on Marvel films, they've had issues on other films where the effects are sorely lacking, to your point. And these, especially in, I mean, from announcement to this, it wasn't very long, and god dang, this is gorgeous. So bravo to the folks at Weta for what they've done and continue to do. Between this and Lightstorm, I think Disney, those investments alone are almost worth the purchase of Fox.
Yeah, no matter what I have to give to the movie overall, 10 out of 10 on the effects in this. They are that seamless. And you know me, I'm kind of a snob in that I do kind of look for seams and kind of look for things. Like in that 2011 movie, I made mention, well, the way they jump up in the house that they're in, it doesn't really look that good. I had my eye out looking for it. And when they interact with humans later, I was looking to see if maybe the cloth wasn't moving right. No, there was a lot of care put into what they did here.
Being introduced to Noah's parents, who his father is sort of the tribal chief, who has a strong affinity for birds. So I like that nature. It's kind of this harmonious Lion King-esque circle of life that they've established. And I have to say, like, I think the first half of this movie is almost flawless. As far as the pacing goes, it doesn't rush really from plot point to plot point. Like, it's a really, outside of an action scene or two, it's a very ponderous movie that really could play with no dialogue at all.
Correct. And they ease us in. And these eagles do. They play a huge part in Noah's upbringing. We'll see him grow to the point where he's trying so hard to get these birds to land on his arm. They won't do it. They'll just peck at him and they attack him. And part of his growing up, part of his maturing is being able to get these birds to trust him. And this movie is a lot about trust. There's a lot of things going on here. You know, we're going to see a human character that has questions of trust later. Trust plays a huge part in where this movie goes. And I do like the way the narrative just kind of seamlessly inserts that in.
Absolutely. So he goes to bed that night. As he's patrolling, he notices, in all likelihood, the same human scavenger that they were teased at earlier, running around the encampment. Noah and her get into a scuffle, and he accidentally cracks his egg during their little chase, so he has to go out and get a new one. And while he's out there, he encounters a rogue group of apes that are not part of his clan, that are carrying the scariest thing of all, cattle prods.
Yes! Oh, I did not think they would introduce these in, but let's not forget, this is 3 centuries later. So I could see these apes holding these and wielding them around. You thought of cattle prods. I thought of those weapons that those guards use in the Star Wars prequels.
Oh, yeah. Grievous's guards?
Yeah.
Well, I like that this movie and this trilogy, and Planet of the Apes in general, has always been about, even though apes become the dominant species over humans, they still make the same mistakes that echo the downfall. Especially here, using the weapon of your previous oppressors when they were all in cages attack other apes. You know, that's clearly there's clearly a message behind that. My only question is, where are they getting all the batteries to power these cattle prods?
Exactly.
It was such a swerve that you come across this and you see that an ape's been hurt, and we see what we believe is a human. So, of course, you know, they ran afoul of humans. No. So to change this up, that we are getting ape on ape or monkey on ape, ape on chimp, whichever way you want to go with it, it was a misdirection that I didn't expect, and I was shocked, and I was like, oh, we're stepping up.
What's that golden rule of ape not kill ape that they're already, even though it's been 300 years of later, that rule has already been broken.
Mm-hmm.
So Noah has to hide. He notices that these apes are carrying chem prods, as I mentioned, and they mention their leader Proximus. Noah makes his way back. The apes follow his horse back to his clan, and he sees that his home is being burned alive. Or I should say his home is being burned, because I don't think wood has feelings like that. And we get, this is our first big action scene in the movie where this ape general kills his father and he drops from the high platform, which is the big shot in the trailer of him falling. I'm surprised that was in the first act of the movie. I thought for sure that was the climax.
Yeah.
But I like when they play that because I'm like, okay, where is this movie going from here?
For sure. And you know what I thought of, guys? It's funny that Disney picked this up. I thought a lot of Bambi while watching this movie. The fact that this ape's father is now dead and he has to get past that and turn into what he is supposed to be without his father guiding him. It reminded me a lot of when Bambi's mom dies in the early stages of that movie. And it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, this is a cool action sequence where they're fighting in the top floor of the treehouse. They're still showing that connection to the eagles where they're letting them go. But here's where my first thought in my head came of an issue. I was a little frustrated that the last movie, War, was ultimately a revenge story for Caesar, and they were doing the same thing here immediately. I thought they could have done something a little bit more different, especially being the next installment.
What do you mean, the same thing?
First part of War is Caesar's family being killed by the villains, and they're doing the same thing here.
Fair enough, but you could make the case that it's a different set than before. But yeah, I see what you're saying, though. They're playing the same beats.
Noah survives that fall, which is a hallmark of Disney properties where people survive dropping stories when they really should be dead. And all he's got is a couple of bumps and scratches to show for it. I guess apes learned how to heal like Wolverine.
You know what I like about this, though? I like this because we don't know who's going to survive this because we have not been introduced to these characters except for the first 30 minutes into the movie or whatever we are at this point. So I don't know if Noah's going to live. I don't know if his friends are going to live. I don't know. You know, obviously his dad passed away, but we have a little bit of a wise man too, you know, a little bit of a teacher with Noah as well. He obviously is dead too. So I don't know until we see Noah move around that he is actually going to survive this.
And I got to say, this entire action scene is mo-capped, and you don't realize that or even think about it while you're watching it. Like, it feels like you have chimps on apes on monkey action and violence, and it is, we talked about the effects, but it is crazy that this could go on as long as it does with fire, so you have different lighting effects, you have very clear motion without any type of degradation in the quality, and it's astounding how great this gets played off. And then, yeah, to have that somber moment, and you don't know who's alive and who's not. And at the end of it, you still really don't know. We are moving at a very quick pace, and I'm invested. Like, I'm just like, oh, like, now what? Like, where do you go from burning down a homestead?
Yeah, I'm the same way. I'm on the edge of my seat at this point. I'm with Matt, where I think the first half of this movie is pretty much flawless.
Noah wakes up. He's by himself, basically. We realize that his clan has either been killed or captured, which they talk about when he's hiding. Buries his father, Logan style, and sets out to go rescue his clan. So this is where they start the thing of him trying to be like his father and have the eagle land on his arm.
Mm-hmm.
Nice little character arc for him throughout the course of this movie. A little bit throughout his journey, he stumbles upon another ape, but he's not part of his clan. This is Raka, who is probably my favorite character in the movie.
He's awesome. And also, right before this, Matt, is, you know, I think it's part of his kind of growing up. In his first big challenge, when his dad passes away and he's wandering around, he sees this big, dark-ass cave right in front of him. And that is his first challenge to mature. It's like, okay, you got to get past stealing these eggs. You got to kind of take on this challenge. And that's kind of a little bit of a way to grow up, shall we say, when he sees this big cave.
Yeah, especially because it echoes the one they didn't go into.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Movie.
But Raka plays into the old movies where he's sort of like Bad Ape and some of the other side characters, where he brings the levity that this movie desperately needs without going too far into Jar Jar territory, I'll say. I thought he was great. This one, the only actors I recognize because he has a recurring role on the Orville. But I like that we have a character who's like a Buddhist monk.
Yeah.
Where he's in not hiding, but he's sort of preserving the word of Caesar as it was intended. Gives Noah the medallion, sort of like it's almost like giving him a cross.
Yeah,
he tells him, and this is an effective way to give the exposition about who Caesar was for people who may not have seen the previous movies. But yeah, this part I think is really effective as far as how this character is introduced and played.
Well, what I like about this, too, is you said, you know, how Caesar was. Well, I want to quote Obi-Wan Kenobi from a certain point of view, because we're going to hear from another set of apes that look at it in a completely different way. So I like the fact that he's being introduced to this by this wise ape. What is this? This is an orangutan, right?
Yeah, he's an orangutan.
Okay, by this wise orangutan who's giving him every bit of exactly how Caesar was, but we're going to see later that's not how it's taken by everybody, and that's how legends are. Everybody looks at different legends in different ways. They weren't alive to see it, so they have to take the word of who's above them. And we'll see, this isn't the way everybody looks at Caesar. And I love that legacy part. You know, we've talked about legacy sequels a lot, boys. We're going to get to more later on this summer. But I think the way this movie handles legacy is about as perfect as you can get.
What I like about this, too, is I feel a distant connection to Dr. Zaius. Obviously, it's just that type of thoughtful way. And just the way that it is done, the voice, the acting, everything on here, this actor really does a good job with it. I recognize the voice is slightly altered, but I'm like, what is it? What is it? For those that have watched The Orville, he's in that and does a really, really good job. But this is, I just love this character right away, and you can't help but smile along with him. And yeah, this is when I start to realize what this movie's going to be about. Every single one of these movies has something to say. And I realize right here what this movie's going to have to say. And I like it. I like it a lot. I also like that they've, I mean, as silly as it seems, that they've made this medallion out of what looks like the window from that very first Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Well, you know, people go around wearing a cross that their savior was killed upon. So, you know, it just, there is something about when it goes into the power of belief and the power of story and how it goes. And yeah, I love this character.
Yeah, and also, part of my problem with war was we're following Caesar throughout that entire thing, knowing that he's going to die at the end. We had to see that entire journey. Here, we're seeing the result of that, and I think, in retrospect, it kind of makes the end of that movie better than what I was thinking before, because that was who these apes are coming to know, but we saw it right in front of our eyes, so we were kind of making comparisons, and I do like that it kind of bears repeat viewings after what they're being told. Here.
There's also the symbolism of, you know, Adam talked about the symbol looking like a window. Well, much like a window, the cages they were in have the bars in front that sort of like the oppression, wearing it as a symbol of pride, sort of like the Jesus thing with the cross that you were talking about. So there's a lot here that I was surprised at the thoughtfulness that this movie had, to be honest, because I thought this was going to be something they just churned out because they had to or wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But Rocca joins him on his journey, and they notice that they're still being followed by the scavenger, the woman that they've seen previously. Rocca offers her food and a blanket, and they give her the name of Nova, which I do have to be honest, did make my eyes roll, because we had a Nova in the previous movie.
Yeah, but they're trying to give member berries where they can, as smooth as they can, but yeah, this was kind of more in your face than it could have been, but this is probably the name that they are aware of. That's how I looked at it.
Doesn't he say, like, why we call them that? I don't know.
Yeah.
So at least they're kind of making fun of it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a loss. They don't even understand where it comes from. And I do like that part of it. And at least we got a Nova reference. At least it doesn't stay. Some people call them humans. Some people call them Nova.
Yeah. Human versus people. And it's also a little ironic that they call her Nova right next to a telescope.
Yeah, I thought of that too.
Yeah, because they're camping in this, like, observatory, and he looks through the telescope. They wake up the next day, and they come across, this is the biggest homage to the original, where it's humans looking like Tarzan, drinking water out of the stream, before the apes arrive on horses and rope them up in nets the same way that Charlton Heston was in the first movie.
The sound work that they put into this, I felt like was pulled right out of that 68 original, and I appreciated that care.
Definitely. There's a lot of loving homages going on here, but I think the most blatant one actually comes later. We'll get to that.
I'm clearly not thinking of it then, because it's not coming to mind. I thought this was the one you were referring to.
No.
So they rescue Nova, and they find out she can talk, where she reveals that my name is May, and that Noah's clan got taken to this settlement that they have to go to. All right, so this character, May. I like the actress, but I feel like this is the one character where she is here just... Your overall thoughts on her are going to depend on where they take this character in the next couple movies. Which is my one knock I can say on this movie is, depending on where they go, this movie could either get better or get worse. Because a lot of this is very much set up for what's to come.
They are setting stuff up, but what I will say about this character is, coming in, I didn't think there was going to be a human in to this world. I thought we were going to have to rely on these apes the entire film, which, by the way, I like the apes. I would have been happy to do so, but for some reason, they feel the need to insert a human character into this. But I'm going to say, the way they use her, I really like. And again, I'm not a huge fan of The Witcher. My fiance loves that show to death, and she's seen all the seasons repeatedly, I think for another reason other than this chick. But I'm not really aware of this girl's work. But I will say, I like her in this because I don't know where she's coming from. I don't know if she's going to live. Again, I'm on the edge of my seat because these are all new characters, and I don't know exactly who I'm going to see live or die by the end of this film. So I like the way she plays this. There's a scene later on that I'm going to point out I really like her in. But I do like her presence. You know, it could be looked at as an easy to say, well, here's a human character just to kind of give people a reason to really care about these apes. But I look at it in a different way. I look at it as these apes seeing this character living off the land, living off this water. They think she's more feral than she actually is because she does talk. The way these apes learn about her is the exact way I learn about her. And I do like the way they use her in that way.
Agree that I was surprised. I thought this was going to be just like the girl that we got in the last one. I thought she was going to be mute or near mute for the entire thing. And I'm really glad they didn't do that. They subverted my expectation. And not only is she not mute, she's not dumb. She's not the regressed type of human. And I think that was that's a cool little change. That's something that we hadn't seen explored this way. So I thought it was a good way to go. Regardless of how you feel about it, it is impressive that she carries the human element of this film. And that could not have been easy, and it's impressive for a film that I thought was going to start with apes. Once we got her, I thought we were going to get humans introduced, and it was going to be a big part of the rest of this film. No, the human we get is her, and mad props to her for being able to carry her weight.
She can carry it, but I do feel like she's a little underwritten as far as not knowing 100% her backstory, which I'm sure they'll do in the later movies. But like I said, I feel like they could have expanded on her more to make this movie feel a little bit more standalone. But, you know, she was better than I thought she'd be, because, like I said, I've never seen The Witcher, and I thought she was just going to be a mute model, but she's not. So they crossed the...
You want Jason Clark back, don't you? I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
Well, she makes me happy that Estella Warren is not here.
There you go.
I think she bears, and it's funny, I discussed this with my dad. I felt she has a striking resemblance to Nova from that first film. I could see her as a child of Nova. Like, I think they just look so strikingly similar.
I was thinking to myself that they're doing, this is not, we're now in the era where they're actually going to be remaking the original movies. Mm-hmm. Like, I was wondering if they were setting up that Proximus would have his own Dr. Zaius, and the big twist at the end was going to be, like, we saw the remnants of human civilization or something.
That would have been a way to go, but it wouldn't have been too satisfying, at least on my end.
No, well, I would have been like, okay, you're just, you know, like Force Awakens, which we'll talk about. That's very much what this movie could have been. But they get to a bridge, which I have to give these apes a lot of credit for their architecture, especially when you get inside this the settlement where they get ambushed, Raka gets swept away, but I'm pretty sure he's going to come back in another movie.
I would think so. I was surprised we didn't see him at the end of this one. Like, it was kind of weird to see him go, and I got to say, man, another scene here. I adore this scene. I was on the edge of my seat as this water comes up, and then we see Proximus, which we'll talk about here in a bit, but this was all awesome. Like, this is really well done.
It was good. This is when I do think that there's still some issues with water and fur, because it's not quite as good as it needs to be, but the action and the emotion is there. I think they killed Raka, because I thought he was going to come back at the end of this, and then I realized that sacrifice wouldn't matter, you know, without it. So, oh, man, that was just heartbreaking to see him go.
The Raka gets swept away, Noah and May get captured and then brought to the ape settlement. Turns out his clan is still alive, like his mother's still alive, his friends are still alive, and we're introduced to Proximus Caesar, coming out in boisterous fashion, giving a big speech about how what a wonderful day it is. And so he's played by Kevin Durant, who, if you've seen a movie over the last 15 years, you've seen him in some.
Yes, Matt, you and I just saw him in Abigail. He was just in that.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Yeah, plays a very different character. He plays villains a lot, but for a guy that big, you'd think he wouldn't have a whole lot of range. But I think he's the standout in this movie.
I love Proximus in this. You know, we've talked about these villains in these previous movies, and a lot of them were mean, a lot of them were ferocious, but every single time this Proximus is on screen, he is vicious, he is ferocious, and he is mean as fuck. And I see him do tons of damage every time he's on screen, and I fear for these characters every time he comes on screen. And by the way, before we go to Adam on this, Matt, this is the other reference that I was talking about. This whole settlement that they have here, this reminded me of the architecture associated with the apes in that first Planet of the Apes movie, like where they were staying. That was the connection I made. But yeah, Proximus is fucking amazing in this. I love how mean and ferocious and how mouth-wateringly vicious this villain is.
It's amazing that we got Proxima Midnight. Wait, no. Proxima? No. That's Solo. Disney's got to have some type of trademark on Proxima, Proximus, Proxima. Like, they got Proxima Proximity Syndrome. Kevin Durant, it's amazing because, yeah, I've seen him in so many things. Going back to one of the horrible Resident Evil sequels.
You know?
I mean, but when he's big and boisterous and doing his, I'm going to call it out right here, his televangelism that he's doing when he's on his makeshift stage, it's such a performance. When he gets quiet and he's talking to you face to face. I remember, though, and this is where I'm distracted, it's the same performance he does in Swamp Thing.
Cool.
Where he played a really cool character in that show that used to be on Max. I don't know what DC has done with it now. He
played the character that John Glover played in Batman and Robin.
Oh, wow.
Basically, yeah. I mean, yeah, he plays the Floronic Man. He plays Jason Woodrue. And he does it really well. But his delivery when he's quiet and talking to you, trying to get you to see his way, is the same delivery. I think he's a great choice for Proxima. And I think this character and what they do with it is such... This is when I understand what this film is about.
Yeah, he's basically Tim Curry from Pass the Ammo, which is a very obscure movie where he plays a televangelist who's all boisterous and, you know, spreading the word, but he's secretly a monster. A little bit of Trump in there, too, certainly.
Yeah, I thought of that.
A lot of Elon Musk.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. Well, if you see Kevin Durant, he looks almost exactly like Elon Musk himself.
Yeah, if Elon Musk hit the gym and was like 6'4".
Exactly.
But yeah, so I could be asked, though, I was bummed they killed him off. That was when we get to the end, I'm like, oh, I wish they kept this character around.
See, I think that's going to depend on, well, we'll get it towards the end of this film, but I think it depends. Do we jump a year? Do we jump 100 years? And I think that's going to depend on who comes back.
That's a good point.
The Proximus believes in Caesar's teachings, but in the way that makes him the ruler, where he has enslaved other clans, where they work on opening the secret vault because he wants what's inside. So the big mystery, I thought J.J. Abrams directed this movie with a literal mystery box inside the vault, but I like how, yeah, he's a monster and a dictator, but he's got some beautiful beachfront property to sell you.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah.
It shows me where this film is going to, and I recognized it when they were at the airport, and then when they were at the observatory. Because I played that observatory level in The Last of Us 2, so I know we're up in the Pacific Northwest. But I see us kind of canvassing the country at this point. We've finally left San Francisco. So I'm loving this area. Then it tells us where we are. Mm-hmm. So there's a little guidepost to let us know where we are on the map.
I also like how they treat him like Dr. Doom, where it's like, yeah, he's a dictator and a monster, but damn, he makes the trains run on time. Like, what do you mean? We love that guy. He's even got his own hype man where we're introduced to William H. Macy, who I could have done without.
Yeah, this was one step too far for me as well. When I saw William H. Macy was in this, I thought maybe he was going to be a voice of one of the apes or something. I had no idea that he actually played a human character in this. I guess he's kind of needed to kind of point May in the direction that she goes in, but she doesn't even end up going fully in on that as well. So yeah, he's just kind of here. Although he does have a few pretty good speeches when they're sitting up and they're paying attention to Proximus's speech and he's talking to her. I think he served well in that aspect, but I'm with you, man. I really could have done without this character.
I like, though, that he serves a role of showing that some people would be willing to be subservient just to exist.
True. And, yeah, that's a good point.
Like Uncle Tom syndrome.
Yeah, and in a movie that's about taking the teachings of the previous and distorting them for your own use, it's good depth to it. I'm glad that he's kept minimally. He's an actor that I'm always glad to show up, though at this point you know that you're seeing William H. Macy, so it's almost a distraction. He does a good job. I'm glad he's not in it too much. And where it goes with it blows me away,
because
I think that changes what I think I'm seeing.
But that whole thing of, like, willing servitude, and we've only seen the humans serve apes as mute labor. This is a guy who's still got his intellect, which means that the virus, I guess, mutated again to where some humans can maintain their speech. I think in the next movie, they'll show the new civilization or what humanity's status quo is. Because I thought at the end of war, it meant the death of intelligent humans as we knew it. But Trevathan tells May that Proximus is all about ancient Rome, and he's basically his hype man, but he's like his teacher almost, with giving him the knowledge that humanity had. But also that information, if you know anything about Rome, I'm sure he didn't tell him that Rome eventually fell and was conquered.
Exactly.
Right?
Proximus is also very much, like, I was thinking of the governor from The Walking Dead. More so the comic.
I was just thinking, I haven't seen the TV show version of it, but I do remember that character from the comic, so more so like that, huh?
Yeah, he's got that ruthless, but also in the TV show he's modeled after, like, a little bit of Bill Clinton.
Oh, interesting.
But it's that he's like, okay, I think Noah can help me open the vault. And he tells her that, well, he tells him that May is a human and only has her own interest in mind. What I like, Proximus is right. She completely has her own interest in mind.
He is telling the truth the entire time. He is literally running the rule of the Sith, where he may be despicable, but he is not lying.
Well, Proximus, Palpatine, pretty similar. You know, in Disney, it's approximately 2.5 hours of a movie runtime.
Oh, God.
Nice.
Noah confronts May, and he says, you're kind of selfish. That night lands, and they agree to open the vault to see what's inside, because May says that there's something in there, a book that will restore speech to humanity. And literally, it is from a certain point of view, to quote Obi-Wan, like you alluded to earlier, where it's not a literal book, per se, because I thought it was going to be, like, literally the Book of Eli, where it's the Bible. With all the biblical references in this movie, if it was actually the Bible.
Yeah, that wouldn't have surprised me. I'm glad they didn't go that route.
Noah agrees to help her enter the vault because he wants to let his people go to be Moses, which is also ironic considering Charlton Heston once starred in this franchise.
Yeah, I thought of that, yeah.
How are they going to do it? So they set up a bunch of explosives around the ravine so that there'll be a great flood, which again, another biblical reference there. Trevathan tries to stop them, and Warren Proximus, but May just chokes him out, no questions asked.
Did not expect, you know, you're like, okay, I see where this is going. Whoa. Yeah. That's the moment where we're sitting there doing it. My dad turns to me and goes, holy shit.
Yeah, this movie does a lot of things unexpected. And again, I like that feeling watching this, you know, going through this. And I was scared. I was scared to see new characters. I was scared to get acquainted with new characters. I was scared to go through yet another story where we have to meet new apes. And at this point, I am still like, what is going to happen here? And I love feeling that way while I'm watching a movie. You know, it doesn't happen too often where you think you can predict the majority of these blockbusters that you go to. But at this point, I have no fucking idea. I don't know who they're going to kill. I don't know who's going to live. I am really, really enjoying what I'm seeing here.
It's one of those questions. Okay, somebody good did a bad thing for good reasons. Or was it even a bad thing? Because you're like, oh my God, what a vicious little thing. Well, no, this is the right move for humanity, but are we on the side of humanity? This is just, it's an interesting development that I never, never saw coming. And it makes me think differently of her immediately.
Well, it's that whole thing of like, okay, humans will kill humans, no questions asked. That reflection of ape not kill ape. So they get inside the vault. And I'm not going to say I was disappointed by what's inside, but I thought it was the most obvious thing of just being a military bunker.
When they're crawling along the side and going in, I think I'm seeing them enter, and I still don't know by the end of it, except that it doesn't make sense because of geography. But I feel like they're entering the cave from the first film, because they're climbing up the sheer cliffs with the water beating against it and entering through the side.
There's also the thought of, I thought it was going to be like beneath where like human civilization was actually locked inside here.
That could have been a way to go, but don't forget too that the most prized possessions in those previous films were guns. I do like that it throttles your expectations. This is not what you'd expect to find in here. But it does kind of play into what happens later on.
They find May's book, which is actually a key for a satellite, and I thought, because I was expecting the cyclical nature of this franchise, I thought these were going to be like nuclear launch codes.
Yeah, I did too.
This housed a nuke.
I still think that's where we're going to go.
Yeah, because they don't really reveal what these are, do they?
No, they're just codes to get the satellite up and running.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just, it connects the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, it's Kyle unplugging the internet and plugging it back in.
It's Starlink.
The apes, in a moment of self-discovery, find the old picture books where they realize that humans were once on top. And it makes them question whether or not they can actually trust May, once again, because it reaffirms everything that the worst of humanity that they've been told about.
Absolutely, and that's why I love how this character figures into this. She could have very easily been the damsel in distress, as Adam pointed out earlier. That's not who she is at all. And she is revealed to be a fiercely independent woman, especially after what Macy has been teaching her and things, and what's been in her head about Caesar and everything else. She doesn't know who to believe, but she ends up getting a bit of individualism here, and you don't know if she's going to turn on Nova and his clan or not, and she's just along for the journey, and I have no idea which way she's going to go until the very end. And even then, and we'll talk about that scene, I'm not sure whose side she's on.
I thought for sure the big reveal was going to be that Proximus sent her.
That would have been the easy way to go, which is why I'm glad they didn't do it.
Yeah. But that's where my my brain went first and foremost. So they open the bunker, they get out, and it's daylight, but there's a horde of Proximus and his army. They threaten to shoot Noah's mother, but May pulls out a gun out of nowhere and shoots him dead, which makes Proximus turn into Palpatine and go, "Good!" And he's like, "Oh yeah, you can leave if you just tell me where the guns are." It's that mm-hmm. thing of like, previous movies where apes realized that firearms were the most powerful weapon for humanity.
I'd forgotten that that was such a part of some of the movies, that the guns mattered so much that it's like, oh, that's right. So you're seeing those stepping stones, and it's nicely done. Again, I don't know what's going on with May. She's such a conundrum, but done in a smart way.
Yeah, and again, we don't know where she's going to go, because we know that they've set these explosives around this entire bunker, so we know that it's rigged to blow, but will she do it? Will Proximus talk her out of it? And again, on the edge of my seat at this scene.
Now, I was going, I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I want to mention, because we saw, and we mentioned it earlier, that we saw humans get rounded up. That's a really, really quick scene that almost plays for the trailer just to make you think there's a lot of humans. We saw William H. Macy's character, and we discussed his demise. That's it. But I'm watching this actress. Never, ever do I think that she's playing against mocap suits.
Yeah.
And I want to mention it, as we're going through this bunker, as she's facing off here while we're on this beach, never do I think I'm looking at mocap. And it's such a testament to what's going on that if you would have told me I would have got one human throughout this 2.5 hours with a bunch of mocap apes, I would have said, oh man, this is not going to work. While I watch the film, I'm consciously knowing that this is something pretty damn impressive. Because
I have to comment about this movie for being a Disney property and having a female character that I don't feel like is shouting women empowerment at me.
Oh my God, for sure.
Yeah, or a Mary Sue.
Mm. Yeah, you can't use that argument at all.
No.
Because she does what Taylor does in Beneath the Planet of the Apes. She triggers the mm-hmm. bombs. She says, screw you apes, I'm going home. She opens the dam and the floodgates literally open, and we're sort of getting a nice little homage to things like Titanic, where, you know, everything's starting to sink.
Well, going back to Matt Reeves, I thought of the Batman here, because there's a scene similar to this in that as well.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the No Man's Land sequence. Mm-hmm. That extra 30 minutes unnecessarily.
Exactly.
May just to escape. Noah and company are being pursued by the general, but Noah traps him in all the piping and leaves him to die. So much for apes not. It's the I won't kill you, but I don't have to save you.
Save you. And it's, you almost feel for him at that moment. I mean, he's using his smart, but when this ape starts to drown, like, you want to feel bad. The emotion that it's brought out is just a damn.
Mm-hmm.
You're conflicted.
Noah manages to escape the bunker, but he gets to the top, and Proximus is there waiting for him.
And again, Proximus is just still so vicious that I don't know if Noah's going to survive this, just the way he's getting attacked here. The way the mocap is and everything else, and Adam, you hit on it, this doesn't feel like mocap. This doesn't feel like special effects. This feels like actual apes attacking each other. I don't know which way it's going to go.
This felt like Simba and Scar fighting on the top of
the Bible. Good call.
With all the lions watching him.
I do like that they use actual ape motions, that when you see mm-hmm. the apes act violently, it's the way that apes do act in the wild when they're doing that chest punch and the axe handle chop that you would get.
The Macho Man.
Yes. I was going Hercules Hernandez. You did it better.
Well, you say anyone other than Hercules and it's better. Power and Glory was the height of his success. Instead of hyenas, though, we got birds. You know, the eagles come back. I mean, not since Tolkien have I seen eagles this embedded into a sci-fi fantasy type of story where it's able to control the one that lands on his arm. And in a scene straight out of Hitchcock's The Birds, they beat the shit out of Proximus and make him fall off the side of the ocean.
These eagles actually do something.
Jeez. To be continued when we get to that series. Yeah, I love this. Because again, it just so plays into who Noah becomes. We haven't said specifically, like, there are scenes where Noah's like, okay, I'm going to do what my dad did. And then these bastards come up and just peck him in the face, and then they fly away. Here, he actually is able to control these birds and actually able to let them land on his arm, and he has full control of them. And then Proximus, he gets attacked, and we see him die the Mole Ram death from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, where he just kind of falls off the cliff, and we follow him all the way down into the sea.
I saw that it was coming with these eagles when he starts to mm-hmm. do it, because of course they're going to flash to it. And I go, ugh, this is going to be so hokey. But when he starts to sing and then the entire clan is getting into it, I should roll my eyes, but they've made me believe in these apes so much that I'm going along and I'm, yeah. you know, I want to pump my hands and sing along with them.
So Proximus is defeated and Noah's able to...
Wait, Matt, how do you, as a fan of the series, how do you feel about this death here? You didn't really say whether you liked it or not.
I was disappointed because I wanted this character to continue. I thought it would have been cool to have, like, one villain for a couple movies.
Okay, so you didn't think this was a satisfying death here?
It's satisfactory for the story they're telling, but I was just disappointed on okay. a personal level.
And I'll say, in the last week, Peter Durand, somebody was asking about it, something else, he goes, you didn't see a body lying on the rocks.
Oh, all you shit. Know about. Here we go. What's he going to... He's going to be a Jedi ghost now? What the fuck?
I mean, it's a guy that works. Peter Durand.
That's opening true. Up.
Yeah, I'm sure life finds a way to quote Jurassic Park.
Somehow Proximus
returns. Noah frees his clan. They return home. They're starting to rebuild civilization. May comes to give him a final goodbye, but there's tension in the air. Instead of cutting it with a knife, she's got a gun behind her back.
She does. This was unexpected, and once again, another scene of this movie where I'm on the edge of my seat, because I don't know which way this is going to go. I'm assuming that Noah's going to be here for this entire series, but I don't know, and I don't know if she's going to use what has been taught to her to shoot her. And when we see that gun, she has it behind her back. It was tension, guys. I was like, what the fuck are they going to do with this? But it doesn't go that way, but there was a few moments there I thought she would.
Yeah, I think it's done well. I think the ambiguity is important, and it makes you think, because if you're human, you just witnessed everything that these apes are capable of. And you've got to be scared for the future of your species, the same way the apes are scared for the future of theirs. So if you're May, wouldn't killing him be the right thing? It's horrible, but you know what? Sometimes killing the person is the right thing to do, and it's, oh man, it's a good showing that she's not what we've gotten with the females in previous movies. She sure as hell isn't the female that Disney likes to give us in general. So there's a lot of thought going on here, and I'm happy to see it.
Yeah, and she is prominently displayed on the poster, so we kind of should have known that she was going to be here till the end. Oh, and this is the moment of acting that I'm going to give this actress a lot of credit for, because she is playing with our emotions with her eyes, where I don't know which way she's going to go. She doesn't lean one way or the other. So up until the very end here, I don't know if she's going to actually kill this character or not.
I think it's entirely possible that she shoots him right here and it kicks off the actual war that we haven't gotten
yes.
of the yeah. planet of the apes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like an actual human versus ape scale war.
Yeah, yep.
But no, she says humans deserve another chance. But Noah says, I don't know if we can coexist peacefully based on what I've learned. So they leave on amicable terms, but they're clearly setting something up for what's to come. And it helps that you can tell what she's thinking because she's got those big-ass Amanda Seyfried eyes.
She does, yeah.
Yeah, goes back to Garrett's Bambi.
Yeah.
Andy Serkis has got some gollum eyes. Noah takes Suna out to go look at the telescope. May makes her way to a human settlement where it's sort of like bubbled from everything that's outside. She gives the key to another supermodel, who's here for one scene, and they finally make contact with another human civilization, which we have not seen since Dawn, because they tease that. But clearly this is like another part of the world. Contact is made, and that's how this movie ends, with the humans being more triumphant than the apes.
Mm.
But it's that through line of both are rebuilding. Yeah. That's what it's ending on.
Yeah, and look, this isn't the Statue of Liberty in the sand, okay? This isn't a complete shocking ending that hits you out of nowhere. But given where we have seen humans throughout the course of this film, I did kind of get a little bit of a jolt, like, oh, okay, so this is where they're going to pick up. So it's not the shocking ending that we've seen in so many of these movies that we've talked about, but it still gave me, it still threw me for a loop.
Absolutely. It's the first one that doesn't really end on a super downer note.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what this franchise... I mean, look, the most well-known wholesome movie ends with a baby chimp getting shot.
Yeah.
between that, Nuclear Annihilation, you know, finding out humanity blew itself up. The last movie ended with Caesar dying. Like,
yes.
All things considered, this is sort of a triumphant ending, all things considered. But is it a triumphant way for us to put this franchise on pause, this retro? Scale of 1 to 10. Adam, what do you give Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes?
Crazy. Going in, there, at no point in this discussion, in these movies, has there been one where I was like, eh, I really don't need any more, I really don't care, until I got to this one. this was obligatory that I was going to have to see this. And yeah, it was new and it was shiny and it was Disney's first apes. But after War, man, that thing ended just so frickin' perfect to me that I didn't need another one. Well, this is another one, but it's a sequel, but it's not, and I appreciate that. You can have its own trilogy here, and I can see them building that way, and I think they're set up to do it well. The story they're telling is pretty damn impressive. This fills in that middle ground in a way that most prequels / interquels will never do well, especially with the Mouse House, who have just screwed it up time and time again. But I could see these three films leading right up to the 1968 Planet of the Apes. We even got a nod to that. Charlton Heston's ship taken off in this series, so for all I know, we're going there. You know, humans can rebuild and then blow themselves up still. I could still see us going that way, and I appreciate it. I think the effects work is such a leap forward from a trilogy that was already leaps and bounds forward from the work that came before that. It is ridiculously impressive. But also the acting that's done. Owen Teague, I don't know from nothing. I really don't. And he looks like a discount Charlemagne, Timothy Charlemagne. But man, he's impressive as all hell. Freya Allen, I thought she was great as Ciri in the Witcher series. I like that series quite a bit. Only partially for a different reason than Jen, because as a heterosexual man, I still love Henry Cavill, but she's really, really good here. All the acting and mocap and emotion that the apes put out, I feel. I think the story is well done. I think it sets us up. For the first time, I feel like it's leading us to a sequel, where the other ones, none of them really felt that way. This one does feel like it's sequel baity a little bit, and I'm okay with it because I want to see where it goes. I think the ending is very intriguing, even though, man, that satellite got hooked up and they started talking quick. My cell phone doesn't connect that quickly, but it's impressive. The story takes you in directions you don't necessarily expect, and I appreciate it. I never feel talked down to, but that this film still had the balls to go, you know what? Some people screw up scripture. People will use scripture to their own advantages and use it to dominate a species is brilliant, but it is not slap you in the face offensive like it usually is when people try to go that route. I appreciate it because I think that that's the type of morality that belongs in these kind of sci-fi movies smartly. So this is a really good film. I enjoy it. I think you still could have cut some stuff out of it. I still think there's little parts that could have been better, but man, this is a really good watch. I'm going to give it a solid. I was deciding between a 7 and an 8. I've kind of cut halves out of my repertoire. Shut up, Jack. So I'm going to give it an 8 because I do think it is that good. It's on its own. It is just a great standalone film, or very good standalone film, and I can't wait to see where it leads. This is the first Apes film where I'm like, man, please give me that sequel. But yeah, 8 on 10. I'm in this kingdom.
Garrett, what say you?
Well, another peek behind the curtain. I haven't spoken to these boys in at least a couple weeks because somebody went on vacation. And so I couldn't get enough of them after we've been recording. So I went back to one of the retrospectives we did last year around this time when we did the Indiana Jones. And at the end of that series, you just heard my heart break over the way it ended. And if there was one movie that I was not looking forward to this year, it was Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. And let me tell you, this is one of the biggest surprises I've ever had since we started doing this podcast. Not just here, but the other place as well. I was engrossed in this. I did not know what was going to happen. And I did not even think about the special effects in this. I just watched it unfold in front of me. And, you know, we've mentioned a couple times at the beginning that, yeah, this movie was 2.5 hours. The only thing that told me this movie was 2.5 hours was my bladder, because I was sitting there and my icy started really wanting to exit around the hour and a half mark. But I soldiered on and I sat through the rest of it because I did not want to miss another minute of this film. I think the villain is very ferocious and just a really, really good way of giving Noah an enemy to fight against and grow up to what he's going to be. I compared this movie to Bambi earlier. I still hold true to that, but you know what? I'm going to do something I haven't done in a long time and give kudos to Disney for gathering this property and giving it the care that it deserves, because the fact that we've gone through these movies and by the end, I was done. War of the Planet of the Apes ended. And I said at the end of that podcast, I did not want another one. That Caesar death was a way to end it, and we were done. And here we have a whole new set of characters, a whole new set of apes, a whole set of humans, and they have put together a hell of a 2.5 hour movie. There's great action here. The stuff in the water, unlike Adam, I thought it looked really good, and I think it holds up pretty well, and it's a very engrossing scene. There's a lot of really good things that they've done here to really engross you in this world. Wes Ball, I wasn't a huge fan of Maze Runner, but it was enjoyable enough. But here he's proven he's a pretty good blockbuster filmmaker as well. So I was on the edge of, as well. I was on the edge of what to score this, but I want to go one higher than Adam. I'm going to give this a 9. And I think the only reason I'm not going to go even higher with that is because I do think the William H. Macy character, as big of a purpose as he serves, I don't think he was really needed here. And some little things here and there that could have been trimmed. But you know what? This was a hell of a way to end this retrospective for now. I know we're going to come back to this in at least a couple years, but I'm going to give this a solid 9. 9 out of 10 for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
So, I thought for sure it was going to be Planet of the Apes. That's what I wrote down for my score, and I can't believe I walked out of this movie as enthusiastically as I did, but it goes to show, sometimes the biggest surprises are the ones you least expect. For something that I had no desire to go see, whether it was a continuation or a soft reboot, this really exceeded my expectations in the best way. I thought this was a lot more sophisticated than I thought it was going to be, which is also impressive given the fact that this movie is as heavy as it is with what it's saying about religion and scripture, to not feel like I was being browbeaten or hit upside with a ruler during Catholic school, I have to commend them on as well. The effects, as you mentioned, they just get better and better, and I never once had an Uncanny Valley segment. I don't even think I saw a peak of it during this entire 2 hours plus. And I did feel the length. That's just because, you know, my back's starting to give out, I think. But all things considered, this is another strong entry in a franchise that's pretty full of them. And I really appreciate that this series continues with, you know, this new series. I always get the sense that these movies are made because they have a story to tell, not because they need to make a quick buck. And with Disney in particular, that's something I do have to praise, because there's far few franchises that I can say they make because they have a story to tell. I do have some issues. I feel like there are components that could improve or shrink based on where they go from here. And it does have a considerable amount of setup, more so than any of the other movies up to this point. But to my surprise, I'm excited to see where they go from here. I can't believe I'm saying, having seen this. So I'm going to echo Adam's sentiment and give this a strong 8 as well. So good job all around. And it's nice to see a movie that we actually do as a new release that doesn't break my heart.
Yes.
Much like Garrett, you know, Indiana Jones, that was my thought exactly. And some other new releases we've done recently, I can't think of many that have surprised me the way this one did. So we're going to put Planet of the Apes on standby until they make another one. But we have some business to take care of, boys. So first, before we rank these, Garrett, I think I should reveal what our next retrospective is.
Yeah, because it's going to be our next new release.
We're going from apes to movies that are crazier than apes. We're going from A Planet of the Apes to the wasteland of Australia. We're doing Mad Max. Furious is almost upon us. I have been pestering Garrett to do this series for years, but we never had the appropriate opportunity. And a new movie, the first spinoff for Mad Max, the Rogue One of Mad Max. I am so fucking excited for Furious, I almost can't even stand it. But Garrett, now that I've gotten you to agree to do this, give both your thoughts on this retro as we're upcoming and who's going to be joining us, because we left Adam at the bus station and picked up another backseat driver along the way.
Yeah, Adam is going to be left at the bus station. He is not going to be joining us for these Mad Max movies. And as Matt has outlined, he has been bugging me to do this series since we started this format, which was basically 2015 when Fury Road had come out. I did not see any reason to do Mad Max, but we have another one coming out. It's starring my girl, and it's starring Chris Hemsworth. And it's once again being directed by George Miller, and there's no better reason to do that series than that. I love the fact that George Miller is back, and by the time this podcast is released, that movie will already have come out. So we are doing a build-up to that review, and to join us for that retrospective is somebody who has full authority to talk Mad Max, given he's from around that area. It is McDuffie. And God, Mick has a Mel Gibson story that needs to be heard to be believed that he revealed on the second episode. So yeah, we are going to do the build up, and I've already given my thoughts on Fury Road over at the other place. We'll see if those have changed, because I was not a huge fan of Fury Road, and we have to do that rewatch in order to understand whether I feel the same way about that film. But yeah, doing Mad Max leading up to a review of Furiosa, and I'm excited for it.
Yeah, we went from what a wonderful day to what a lovely day.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of lovely, who wants to go first with their ape rankings?
I'll take the bullets.
Please.
All right. So let's do from the bottom up.
Oh, crap. Okay.
Just flip your paper upside down.
Just say 2001. Just go ahead.
So, going from the bottom. No, it's not 2001.
Oh, wow.
It's... It's two. It's Beneath the Planet of the Apes. I couldn't stand that film. I'm sorry. The Mutants, it seemed like a made-for-TV. I couldn't stand Beneath. Then it's 2001, Planet of the Apes, for all the reasons we discussed. Man, you know, they kind of get good after that. That's the problem. I'll go from there. I'm going to go Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. Then, and here we go, I'm going to go Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. That one just underwhelmed me so much after years of talking about how great it was.
Wow.
Then I'm going to go up and go Battle for the Planet of the Apes, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which finishes out with the originals and the new. I'm going to go original 1968 Planet of the Apes, kind of tied with, you know what, no, I'm going to go Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes first. I put them side by side, but I'm going to go Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, the original Planet of the Apes. I think there's something magical about that one. And then War for Planet of the Apes. I think it's just transcendent in what it does.
You missed one. Where would you put Escape?
Oh, did I miss Escape? Oh, damn it. I did miss it. That's my bad. I'm going to put Escape just under Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. So that'll be, what, my fourth? I absolutely love that there's something just fun and jovial and still important socially about that film. I think it's one of the better ones. It's my second favorite of the original five.
So just to confirm, from 10 to 1, you have Beneath at 10. You have 2001 at number 9. Conquest at 8?
Yeah.
And then Battle?
Battle.
Then what? Dawn?
Yep.
Then you have Escape?
Then it would be... No, Rise.
All right, so you got Rise at 5, then Escape?
And then Escape. And then Kingdom, Planet, War.
All right, Garrett, you want to go next?
Yeah, I can go. Wow, yeah, War number 1, huh?
Yeah, he's got War number 1 and wow. Beneath number 10.
Oh, boy.
So based on that joke, I assume 2001 is your bottom...
Yes. Yes. And it's weird because before we started this retrospective, I'd only seen two other ones, but I didn't think that that would have happened. But the reason why I put 2001 as my last is because it really adds nothing to the lore of this franchise other than having a twist ending that really, in the grand scheme of things, doesn't make a lick of sense, even though I liked it at the time. But the fact that Tim Burton and company couldn't add anything to the lore of this series really puts it down on the very, very bottom. Number 9, this is going to be controversial, but I put War of the Planet of the Apes. I did not find... I mean, look, it's the effects are great. I think the Woody Harrelson arc in that is, you know, it adds some to it, but I was really tuned out of that movie. It took me two, three times to actually get through it. As I mentioned in that podcast, war movies do nothing for me, and you even put apes in it.
As a guy who loves Star Wars.
Well, that's fantasy, though. We're going to get to those.
I'm going to get blasted for Dawn, so that's fair.
Number 8, I put Conquest. Conquest was just, I think of all of those older ones, I didn't really have a really good time watching that movie. Number 7, I put Battle for the Planet of the Apes because, as we mentioned on that podcast, if you're going to call something Battle of the Planet of the Apes, you have a goddamn battle. And that movie really was more catered towards children. And with the exception of Roddy McDowall, I didn't really enjoy that one. Number 6, I went with Beneath. And the reason why I went with Beneath as number 6 is just because of the fucking nihilistic ending that that movie had that literally blew me away when I was watching it because of the fact that they just had a nuclear bomb go off by the end of that. Number 5, I put Rise. I would have thought it would have actually been lower, before we started this retrospective, but I liked seeing where Caesar had come from. I was sad that we didn't see James Franco come back. Yes, we saw him in footage, but that doesn't count to me. And I just loved seeing the apes just go apeshit on the Golden Gate Bridge. Just a really, really good film, and John Lithgow really added a lot to that as well. Number four, I put Escape. Escape from the Planet of the Apes, because I thought that movie just had a really good pace to it, and of all the ones that had something to say, that one really said the most to me in watching it. Number three, I put Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I mentioned on that podcast that Dawn was a spectacular sequel that I loved. I was so glad I was finally able to catch up to that movie, and I've actually watched it two times again since we did that podcast. Number two, I am very sad I have not gone back to see Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, because I want to see if my high ranking really holds up after another viewing, because I only got to see it that one time, but that one time really captivated me, and I don't know if I, knowing what's going to happen, is going to change that ranking, but as of now, I just had a hell of a time in that movie, and it's just one of those movies I really want to see again. And number one, you know, I could have put Kingdom on top, but I think just the way the original Planet of the Apes starts us off just makes it deserve its top spot, because that movie was so innovative at the time. It was just so well written, so well performed. It had everything that these movies have been building on since then. And to this day, you'll see references to that original film, and you'll see homages to it, even outside the Planet of the Apes universe. And that movie was so influential, and yet it does not feel like homework. If I'm telling you to watch the original Planet of the Apes, it's because it's a really good movie, not because, you know, you need to know what came before. Just had so much to say, so much done in it. That ending will never be topped as far as shock value goes, even though they tried in this entire series. But Planet of the Apes 68 would be my number one.
So Garrett's list, 2001. War, Conquest, Battle, Beneath, Rise, Escape, Dawn, Kingdom, 1968.
Yes, sir.
So just for a point of comparison, you two share four of the same top five. So your lists are not all that far apart as far as the top goes, but you both have a different number 10, and I have a different bottom last place. So let's go to my list. I have Battle at the very bottom, because I jokingly called it Recession of the Planet of the Apes, because the budget went kaput, like the nuclear bomb. I think it's sloppy. I think the messaging is very muddled, and it feels too much like a rehash of just bringing back the humans, some of which we've seen from the previous movie. And it's the one time I felt like they were just out of ideas. So that was my number 10. Number 9, to the surprise of no one, I'm going to go with Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes. Just the wrong project for Burton. The makeup's great, but all the criticisms that have lasted 20-plus years later, like Mark Wahlberg and Estella Warren, you know, the ending, it being really clunky, the messaging, I agree with all of them. So I think it's one of those bad movies that's kind of deserving of its reputation. And then I like the rest of them. So for 10 movies to only have two I dislike, that's a pretty good bar. My number 8 would be, I would go Beneath number 8 just because of the audacity of the ending, and I do think the second half is considerably better than the first half. It does have the problem of the first half is a retread with a less captivating actor, so I fully admit that's what holds it back. Then I go Dawn on the Planet of the Apes. I know everyone went, pardon the pun, ape shit over that movie, but I was left wanting more, especially with Jason Clarke and his no-acting ass. So that's my number 7. Then I'm going to go Escape number 6. I think the lighter tone was definitely needed after Beneath, but it still has that ending where Cornelius, Zira, and their baby die. So it's still got that through line of these movies not having good endings. So now we get to my top 5. I'm going to go with Rise as my number 5. Again, much like Kingdom, pleasant surprise. It's kickstarted this reboot series. My number 4, I'm going to go Conquest. I'm the highest on Conquest of all of us. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really strong one. That one's also got the most anger in it as far as what it's trying to say, but I think that was reflective of the time, and I think it's the best performance Ronnie McDowell gives in the entire series, especially his ending speech. So now we get to the top 3, and this is where it gets hard. I'm going to go Kingdom number 3, just based on a first viewing. It might go down a bit, might go up more based on a second viewing, but as it is now, very surprised that it's this high. Number 2, I'm going with the original Planet of the Apes, and my number 1 is War. I think War, much like to Adam's point, I think it's one of the best blockbusters we've gotten in the 21st century. It checks all the boxes. Unlike Garrett, I do like a good chunk of war movies, but I'm a sucker for prison escape films like Bad Boys or Escape from Alcatraz, and I just think Serkis gives a powerhouse performance in that movie, and I love the oppressive nature without feeling like I'm watching a Zack Snyder movie. So my list, Battle, 2001, Beneath, Dawn, Escape, Rise, Conquest, Kingdom, Planet, War. So some variants on our lists.
You could not get more different. Honestly. Except all three of us have Rise at number 5, which was interesting.
All of us have Kingdom at 3.
No, I have Kingdom at 2.
Oh, yeah, you have it at 2. So, you know, we share a lot of the same feelings. We do have some differences. All three of us have a different number 10. Adam and I share number 1. All three of us have Planet in the top 2.
You and I share the top 3.
Yeah, literally, beat for beat. And then just flip a couple. And so I had a lot of fun doing this Retro Boys, and I gotta say, I have really grown to appreciate this franchise as a whole, to the point where I think it might be in my top 10 favorite franchises ever. Like I said, to have 10 movies over 45 years, and for me to only dislike 2 of them, and even then, Burton's movie is not one of the worst things I've ever seen, and I don't feel that way about Battle. So, I think this franchise has shown it's got the legs, and it's been able to reboot to, some would argue, a higher standard than the original series.
I agree. It's the same way when I look at these 10 and I go, you know, I don't actively dislike other than 1, 1.5 here. You know, it's amazing how these 10 still hold up. And it's amazing that the three of us can appreciate and still say that original still, even with the remakes, reboots, that original still holds true to its vision and what it means to cinema. It's impressive. And yeah, to your point, I think this franchise really matters. It's still impressive today.
Yeah, the fact that they can remain relevant to this day astounds me. And I thought the tipping point was going to be this last one. I thought I was going to go to this last one, especially after War, and say, okay, what can you bring me? Well, this last one was more of a summer blockbuster movie. I'll go ahead and say that. And I've complained a lot with War, where I didn't really think War had too much to say other than it was a war movie. I know we discussed that in that podcast. Go back and listen to that discussion. But what they did with this, I've seen some complaints that it's gone more the blockbuster summer route. And I disagree. I just think it's made it just as relevant as it's ever been. And I look forward to where this series is going. And I would not have said that before we started this thing, because I was not looking forward to this movie at all, as I've mentioned when we started this series. But I'm glad that we've gone through this series. And what I've loved about doing it is we went through those movies in the 70s, and it took on everything from nuclear war to racism to oppression and everything else. And I respect the fact that these filmmakers feel the need to do that. And it did not feel the need to give us just a scary, scary villain. I mentioned that the one in this last one was freaking ferocious and mean. And I would think it would not have gotten any bigger or any scarier than Michael Clark Duncan in that 2001 movie. But they took that and they really ran with it. And if they can keep it as entertaining as this one was, who knows what the hell that they can do with this. Whether or not movies stay, theaters stay around or not for the rest of it is still to be determined. But I was really, really impressed by this series and the ending of it.
So with that said, for a franchise that both of you were not particularly invested in, I'm glad you guys got something out of it, considerably more than I thought you would. Listeners, thank you very much for joining us on this journey. Who knows, a couple years we might come back to this. Because as we mentioned, the movie's doing well financially, it's got good word of mouth, and clearly they're setting up for something in the not too distant future. So, until next time, when we begin our journey into the wild world of Mad Max, we will learn. Apes will podcast. I will podcast, and I will conquer. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Let me make a last appeal to your reason before we inflict more of this on you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast.
Thank you.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Tell me something, McDonald. Can we make the future what we wish?
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Aldo was right. War has come.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
So many questions I want to ask.
And if you enjoyed this review, please head on over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast platform of choice to access our Percolated Media archives and hear our reviews of other franchises like Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Pirates of the Caribbean, the films adapted from the published works of Stephen King, Top Gun, the DC Universe featuring Batman, the Superman DC Universe, and so many more.
And so, Mandemus, we must be patient and wait.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Do they look like just apes to you?
Given the power to alter the future, have we the right to use it?
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I'll abide by that finding.
Just hear what I have to say.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You just imagine that he hurt you.
For the moment, we should follow their example.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
In one of the countless billions of galaxies in the universe lies a medium-sized star, and one of its satellites, a green and insignificant planet, is now dead.
And I swear that's a Disney mandate, because Indiana Jones was 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Disney Star Wars, those are all over 2 hours. What was the Marvel movie with Angelina Jolie? That one was like 3 hours.
Eternals.
I was surprised they went there, because, you know, it's 2024, and we're as divided as ever still.
Yeah.
So to put that out there, I thought was pretty commendable.
Adam, you were going to say something. Go ahead.
I'm saving it.
Okay. Well, speaking of saving things, they're trying to collect these eggs out of the...
So, bravo to the folks at Weta for what they've done, and continue to do. Between this and Lightstorm.
And it's not a bad thing. Are we going to talk about Proximus now, or do you want to wait?
We can wait, because he doesn't show up until halfway through the movie.
Okay. Wait, you're talking about the main baddie in this?
Yeah. It's okay. Like halfway before you first see
him. I thought he was here. Okay. So
no, you don't see him until they go to his base.
You're right. Okay, carry on.
And rope them up in nets the same way that Charlton Heston was in the first movie.
For sure. Yeah. I actually thought go ahead, Adam.
Sorry. The sound work. It's the same performance he does in Swamp Thing.
Cool.
Where he played a really cool character in that show that, used to be on Max. I don't know what the fuck DC has done with it now.
He played the character that John Glover played in Batman and Robin.
Oh, wow.
Basically, yeah. I mean, yeah, he plays the Floronic Man. He plays Jason Woodrue. And he does it really well. But his delivery when he's quiet and talking to you, trying to get you to see his way, is the same delivery. Because I've seen that entire series like 4 times, yeah, over and over. The TV series is phenomenal. Shut up.
I echo his sentence. I will back him up on that.
But
Trevathan tries to stop them and warn Proximus, but he just chokes him out, no questions asked.
Oh, Adam just left the conversation. God dang. There he is.
Sorry, that went silent right in the middle of it. Like, the timer was still going, and I was talking. Sorry.
I was just saying when Trevathan got put in Roddy Piper's super hold and doesn't wake up.
Did not expect.
This felt like Simba and Scar fighting on the top
of
the
Oh, yeah. Good call.
With all the lions watching him.
I do like that they use actual.
Scale of 1 to 10. God, I can't talk. Adam, what do you give Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes?
I'm going to give this a solid 9. 9 out of 10 for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Just for the record, you guys should prepare to rank these because I'm going to do mine and I got mine already set.
Oh, boy. Okay. Give me a few minutes.
All right. Well, I'll do my spiel, but I wanted to give you guys the heads up since we probably should rank these. So, I thought for sure it was going to be Planet of the Apes based on our conversation because that's what I wrote down for...
Planet of the Apes. Good one.
That's what I wrote down for my score.
All right, boys. Have a good day, and Matt, we'll talk very soon. Let's get together with Mick.
Shoot Mick a message about doing Thunderdome.
All right, I will. Adam, have a good day, sir. Have a good week.
You too. Don't need another hero.